Welcome to this very special service when we will be exploring the issue of the state budget deficit and the threat to education in the state. To help us set a course, our own Donna Howard will address us and help us understand or begin to understand this very important issue.
Well, of course, we all know that a budget is a moral document, so here we are in our church talking about a budget. Though I typically prefer speaking extemporaneously with limited time, I decided to script my comments. I'm going to try to convey what's happening with our state's budget in 5 minutes or less, so let's get started. Texas is an overall low tax burden state. In fact, we're 48th in the nation in terms of local and state taxes combined per individual. That doesn't mean our tax bills are actually low because we are overly dependent on sales and property taxes to fund our government. We've got some of the highest sales and property taxes in the nation. At the same time, according to a 2010 report of the Legislative Budget Board, our state's version of the federal CBO, we are 50th in the nation in terms of expenditures per capita. We're quite stingy. Our current biennial budget is about $182 billion, but we only have discretion over about $87 billion of those dollars. Of that, 85% goes to public and higher education and health and human services. We have a shortfall of $27 billion. That means in order to balance our budget, which we're constitutionally required to do, and in order to balance our budget only using cuts, which those in power have determined is the route we must take, we have to make serious cuts in basic education and health and human services. You may have heard our shortfall is only $15 billion. Both figures are actually correct. To provide the same services we currently provide leaves us $15 billion short. To provide the same services we currently provide and to include population growth and increased demand for services results in a $27 billion shortfall. To give some perspective, we grow about 80,000 new students in Texas every year, essentially a new Austin Independent School District every year. But our budget will not provide schools with the necessary increases in dollars to teach those students, even though we require them to educate every student who comes through their doors and to provide each and every one of them with a quality program that addresses all their needs so they can be college and career ready. So how did we get here? The perfect storm, if you will, includes the recession, which seriously impacted the state's major source of revenue. Sales taxes make up about 55 to 60% of our state's budget. The use of one-time federal dollars to the tune of $12.5 billion, which were used to balance our current budget and which will not be available to us in the next biennium, and the so-called structural deficit, which was caused by the 2006 compression of school property taxes without sufficient state dollars to compensate. Basically, we reduced property taxes by a third from $1.50 to $1, which equaled about $14 billion in reductions. The state swapped other taxes to make up for the reduction, an increase in cigarette taxes, used car sales taxes, and a revised franchise tax, the margin tax, which has significantly underperformed. The problem was that it was not a revenue-neutral swap, and we've been counting on surplus dollars to cover the swap. Of course, that only works when the state has a surplus. To make matters worse, the amount of money a school district can raise per pupil was frozen at 2006 levels. So any property value increases since then benefited the state as it realized a windfall of anything above the frozen target revenue. The deal was supposed to be that if property values decreased, the state would make up the difference so that schools could always count on that frozen 2006 level. However, now that the state doesn't have the funds to the tune of about $9.8 billion for schools, The proposed budget calls for the legislature to change the school funding formula so that, abracadabra, we no longer owe you that amount. That's why you're seeing all the headlines about every school district in the state grappling with how to cut their budgets, increase class sizes, and lay off teachers and staff. And to make matters worse for them, we've tied their hands regarding increases in local property taxes by preventing locally elected school boards from accessing additional revenue without an election. But even if they did get support from their taxpayers, this is really just the state shifting the burden to the local property taxpayers at the same time we are claiming that our budget shortfall can be solved without new taxes. So what can we do? Our options are to cut the budget. And by the way, we already asked many in state government to cut their budgets by 7.5%, meaning that further cuts will probably result in large state employee layoffs. To find new sources of revenue, probably expansion of gambling, which will only provide about $1 billion per year and not substantially address our budget problem, and to tap into the rainy day fund. We're finally hearing from the chairman of appropriations in the House that we must use at least some of the rainy day fund, which is projected to have about $9.4 billion in it at the end of the next biennium. But of course, the $4.3 billion he's proposing will only go so far in a $15 to $27 billion shortfall. Additional accounting maneuvers are being planned, such as pushing end-of-year payments into the next year, which could save us about $3 billion, though, of course, that would need to be covered in the subsequent biennium. And some are looking at closing loopholes in taxing. So there you have it, our current budget crisis in a nutshell. The bottom line is that we have to determine and have honest conversations about what we expect state government to provide, how much it should cost, and how we want to pay for it. We know that it's important to have a business-friendly environment that attracts those businesses to our state to create jobs. But we must balance that with providing the necessary revenue for infrastructure that supports those businesses and the families they bring to our state. Quality public schools, investment in higher education that creates the necessary workforce, transportation that allows us to get from our homes to school and work. The future of Texas and our economic prosperity, what we're going to pass on to our children and grandchildren, demands that we behave like grown-ups and find a rational, balanced approach to addressing our budget crisis. Thank you.
As Donna was saying, the budget, or any budget, is indeed a moral document because it declares what people value and care about. And to continue our examination of this, we are very fortunate to have Bea Moorhead with us. She is the Executive Director of Texas Impact, a position that she has held since April of 2000. And during her tenure, Texas Impact and their membership has more than quadrupled, and the organization has received national recognition for its work. Bea holds a master's degree from the Lyndon Baines Johnson School of Public Affairs, and she is an ordained elder in the Presbyterian Church. Could you join me in welcoming Bea this morning?
Thanks for having me. I am going to try to pick up where Representative Howard left off in talking to you a little bit more about what's going on with our state budget, but I'm not going to give you a lot of numbers. She did a really good job giving you kind of a basic framework for understanding where we are and how deep of a hole we're in. The one number that she didn't say that I want to maybe just sort of let's all think for a minute, when she said $27 billion, the amount of money that she said the legislature has discretion over, so the general revenue part of our budget, is $87 billion. So we're talking about essentially a 30% shortfall, which is just not anything that's in the realm of Texas's experience ever in its history. There's a couple of specific points that I wanted to be sure to make, and they are relating to the rally that I know you're going to hear more about on March 12th. You've probably already heard that on March 12th, there is a large event planned at the Capitol. It's called Save Our Schools. Hopefully all of you all are already signed up to come. If you're not, I'm sure it's just because you haven't gotten to it yet. But I want to make sure you understand that Save Our Schools is the first of basically several weeks of events at the Capitol that are all coming under the banner of Save Our State. And the culminating one of those events excuse me, is on April 6th. We're hoping to have 10,000 people at the Capitol on a weekday, which is a challenge. So people who are in Austin, we're hoping that you'll, you know, pull your weight and come to the Capitol to help the legislature understand that this is not just an issue about education. It's not just an issue about state employees. It's not just an issue about nursing homes. This is an issue about what kind of state we want to be. And in the couple of minutes that I have to talk to you, that's what I want you to think about, is the reason we're having the budget crisis that we're having right now. In one sense, it is because of the recession, because of the structural deficit. We name all these sort of fiscal policy issues. But in the larger sense, it has to do with a fundamental mismatch between what kind of state we want to be, what kind of people Texans want to be together, and what we're willing to do to make that happen. And I want to just use public education because that's sort of the first order of business for the state. It's our big constitutional duty, isn't it, to have a system of free public education. We've had that since the beginning of Texas as a state. But once upon a time, when the founding fathers of Texas wrote those words, they meant a system that went through the eighth grade. And they meant a system where if you were too sick or too poor or too bad, too full of problems, you weren't included in that system. We don't have that system anymore. Now we have a system where we want every child in the state, no matter what their issues might be or what their family circumstances might be, to participate in the system, not through the eighth grade, but through the 12th grade. We aspire for them to go on to college, and the world they live in is totally different. We expect them to know more by the end of sixth grade than grown-up Texans knew when they wrote the Constitution. That's a more expensive system, but we've decided as a people that that's the people we want to be. Well, we have to pay for that system to have it. In education, in healthcare, we used to have a very high child mortality rate. We decided we don't want to have that either. We have to pay if we want all of our children to be healthy. We have to pay if we want our seniors to be able to be in a nursing home where they're well taken care of. We have to pay for roads. We have to pay for criminal justice. So the big issue is not sort of the numbers. It really is the moral concern about what kind of budget we want to have. And the cuts that are being proposed don't just, in a short-term way, cause disruption in this program or that program. They move us in the direction of a community that isn't the community we think we want to be. Several years ago, and I'm just going to close with this thought, there was kind of a crisis in the junk food industry that you might remember. And the crisis was that it came to light that there had been introduced a new size of junk food packaging called king size, and everyone was very excited about king size. And then it turned out that all it really was the size that you used to get, but now it costs more, and the thing that was referred to as regular was still the same price, but it wasn't the same amount. It was much smaller. And people were offended because they thought, if I'm paying the same amount, I should be getting the same amount of stuff. When you hear we're going to balance the budget with cuts, I want you to understand you're getting an 8-ounce soda, not a 12-ounce soda. that we're going to have, you may pay the same amount, but you're not getting the same, it's one thing to say you're not getting the same government. I want to tell you, you're not getting the same community. Bluebell ice cream, what does it say on the package? Still half a gallon, but it's not still $3.
My remarks today represent my own views, not the opinion of the board of this church, although I would like to think they all would agree with me, or necessarily of any of our wonderful special speakers, or of the church itself. I emphasize they represent my own views. I see the specific issue that stands before you in the context of my life growing up in the South, in my having lived in the West, in the Pacific Northwest, and gotten a sense of the flavor of different parts of the country, and my experiences in spending quite a bit of time over the last 18 months prior to being here working in Canada. And being a student of the political history of our country. Not a scholar of that, but a student of that. And I see the issue that stands before you, described so succinctly by Dee and Donna, as part of a larger issue. And this larger framework is that our government at the state and national levels is today controlled by powerful financial interests whose aims do not coincide with the public good. These interests, representing concentrations of wealth, appear to have as their objective the sole goal of increasing their wealth ad infinitum. And these groups, both in concert with others within their party or singly, are exerting their mighty influence through financial pressures via an army of lobbyists and the ultimate weapon of either extending or withdrawing the financial support which spells life and death to the political careers of many, if not every single person who is a politician. There are many excellent articles and indeed books which describe over the last decade in undeniable detail this pattern of private moneyed interests overriding and negating a reasonable concern with the public good. An article in the August 30th, 2010 issue of The New Yorker, written by Jane Meyer, is an example of this. In this book, she details very precisely how much of the Tea Party movement in this country was guided and directed and funded by two extraordinary wealthy brothers. The point being, and I could cite many such exposés, the point is that this belief that concentrations of wealth are dominating our political system is not science fiction. It is not the product of the fevered mind of conspiratorial fanatics. It is not the outpouring of wild speculation, but it is real. It is present. It is a danger. It is based on facts and is discernible by anyone willing to take the time to connect the dots. One consequence of this series of events is that, as we all know, wealth is being concentrated in the hands of fewer and fewer persons in our society, the United States, but also on a global field. And that the gap between the so-called super rich and everyone else is widening. And there is another manifest consequence to this pattern. There is a gap between these interests of concentrated wealth and what the vast majority of average human beings and citizens, such as ourselves, actually want. And this gap is showing up again and again in the wide divergences between what the American public actually wants and what our lawmakers nationally and locally do. For example, recently, only last week, according to a 60 Minutes Vanity Fair poll released and conducted in late last year, a strong majority of Americans think the United States should raise taxes on the wealthiest members of society or cut military spending to balance the budget. Yet, right now, even as we speak, the politicians in power in Washington want to extend the tax cuts permanently for wealthier Americans, while also at the same time demanding spending cuts to curb the $1.3 trillion deficit. 61% of Americans in the poll I mentioned earlier would rather see taxes for the wealthy increased as a first step to tackling the deficit. And the next most popular way of dealing with our country's fiscal needs, chosen by 20%, was to cut defense spending. The poll was a very solid one, with a margin of error plus or minus 3 points. The findings of this poll reflect a contrast, a gap, across a wide number of issues that include health care and the environment, as well as education and other issues. There is a clear, unambiguous divergence appearing again and again between what the American people want and what our leaders are doing at the state level and at the national level. And at the heart of this divergence, again and again, is the fact, the reality, that centers of concentrated wealth are driving our political process. It is possible to say, well, this is how it has always been, yet that is not exactly so. As the New Deal took hold, and as FDR prepared for re-election in 1936, an organization called the Liberty League, which foreshadowed many of the organizations operating in our society today, launched a major effort to unseat him. FDR took on the forces of wealth behind the Liberty League and other like-minded groups. He characterized the League as a tool of what he called selfish big business. And FDR went on to remind the public that wealthy interests behind such groups tended, and I quote, to consider the government of the United States as a mere appendage to their own affairs. shades precisely of what is occurring today. He went on to say that based on the experience of the late 20s and the early 30s, I quote, "We now know that government by organized money is just as dangerous as government by organized mob." In 2008, our country almost went under economically because of the truth of this statement that FDR just made. He went on to say, "Never before in all of our history have these forces been so united against one candidate as they stand together. They are unanimous in their hatred for me. And I welcome their hatred." I wish he had not used such harsh language, but you get the picture that he had a very realistic view of the world and a very realistic view of the forces that were aligned against him. And he did not whitewash what was there or turn in fear, but spoke the truth and stood his ground. In this, the forces arrayed against FDR were submerged by him and the events of World War II. In the 1970s, and from that point, the same forces, the same motivations behind FDR's enemies at that time reemerged and had become ever more sophisticated in their orchestration of political forces in their favor. In the Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission case, in which the United States Supreme Court upheld that corporate funding of independent political broadcasts in candidate elections cannot be limited under the First Amendment, we see the triumphant ascendancy of these interests of concentrated wealth. And now we are seeing, in state after state, the consequences of living in the political context in which moneyed interests dominate, and that point of view is not questioned. Consider for a moment the issue of education and the current budget crisis. Any action which leads to the decreasing of the quality of education for a city, for a state, for a nation, is profoundly destructive to the long-term well-being of its people. The role of teachers is one of the most important, if not the most important, role in our society. It is teachers who give our young the priceless gift of learning. To learn, to acquire knowledge, to have a love of learning, is to be human. So in a sense, teachers give our children the gift of a human and humane life. The level of civilization rises and falls with the level of education. Teachers play a more important role in a country, city, or state's economic development and future than anybody on Wall Street or in Washington or anywhere else. The work of teachers reaches into everything, from the numbers of people who do and can do basic science to the capacity of the people to be informed citizens. How could leaders who ever seriously consider draconian cuts to education and at the same time care about the future? It is impossible. Under the present paradigm in which we live and move and have our being, in which the ultimate good is the infinite increase of the already vast wealth of concentrations of wealth, it is inevitable that the solution to tight budgets is to cut the funding of the most vulnerable. But if we look at this issue in terms of the value and importance of education and the good of the majority and the well-being of people and the future of our children, the approach immediately and inevitably becomes we will find the money because the value of education for our children and youth and the well-being of society and the assurance of a better future demands it. We will find the money even if it means thinking out of the box of how we have thought about sources of revenue. I have learned to ask, whenever confronted by a problem or controversy, to first ask myself the question, what part do I play in this? I have found that this is much more productive than demonizing others, blaming others, or becoming a victim or taking the posture of a victim. And I would say that what you and I and other ordinary people have contributed to this problem is passivity. Our passivity is making it very easy for the persons and groups that represent the interest of concentrated money to do what they are doing. Someone said, don't ever waste a good crisis. So I ask you, don't waste this crisis, but use it to take action. I ask you to join with others from across the state to join the Save Texas Schools rally. I ask you to call every friend, every relative that you still talk to, and every warm body you might be acquainted with, and to ask them to join you in this march. I ask you to use Facebook and Twitter and every social media that you have at your disposal to get the word out about this march. Join your fellow church members as they show their support for full funding of public education in Texas. Will it help? I don't know. Will it make a real difference? I don't know. Is it the answer? I don't know. Surely it is only a part at best of an answer. But by taking action, by taking a stand, you will know that in this hour when the concentrations of wealth that rule society are betting on your passivity, and in this society controlled by them, where money is put before the well-being of education, you stood up, you let your voice be heard, you acted, and that is all any of us can do. Years ago, a wise man who saw all of this evolving spoke about a state dominated by moneyed interests. And this person, Noam Chomsky, wrote, and I quote, "It is necessary to destroy hope, idealism, solidarity, and concern for the disenfranchised, the poor, and the oppressed, and to replace these dangerous feelings with self-centered egoism, a pervasive cynicism that holds that the state capitalist order, with its inherent inequalities and oppressions, is the best that can be achieved. In fact, there are great campaigns of propaganda underway to convince people that it is not only what they should feel, but it's what they do feel. Do not succumb to that. Let us not let this happen to us. Let us speak with our actions and our heart. Participate in the march of education. Let your voice be heard. I share with you this benediction. May an awareness of the gifts of life and the preciousness of each moment be in us and dwell with us. May the memories we gather here give us hope for the future. May the love we feel here give us strength for the living of our days. And may we go in peace until we meet again. Amen.
This is a presentation of the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. For more information, visit our website at www.austinuu.org.